As the effects of climate change become more obvious across the world, the idea of doctoring Earth's atmosphere to reduce global warming is making a comeback. In April 2023, Scientific American headlined its rejection of this supposed solution, but engineers at major universities like Harvard and Oxford and Yale embraced geoengineering. Some major media are touting it, and so are some prominent tech entrepreneurs, even those who acknowledge it would also do a lot of damage. A UN space treaty from 1972 holds governments responsible for damage caused by a space launch from their territories, but today space is colonized by private actors capable of blithely trying whatever they imagine. Why would we trust the future of our climate to such sorcerer's apprentices? Naomi Klein has some ideas. Stay tuned.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This idea of fixing the sky assumes that the Earth's climate systems are simple enough that we could treat the Earth as if it had a thermostat attached to it, and when it gets too hot, you can just turn down the temperature.
Today's program content was recorded in 2011 for Australia's national program Women on the Line. More international climate talks have occurred, but the cultural revisioning Naomi Klein urges has far to go.
Welcome to Women on the Line, Community Radio's National Women's Current Affairs program, produced at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne and broadcast on the Community Radio Network. I'm Eleanor McInerney. This week, Naomi Klein, the activist and author of No Logo and the Shock Doctrine, turns her attention to the environment. At the World Social Forum held in Dakar in February, Naomi Klein spoke to a workshop of climate activists mobilising for next year's United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development, the Rio Plus 20 Earth Summit in May 2012. Climate activists are concerned that governments and corporations will use the Rio Plus 20 meeting to promote geoengineering as a means of mitigating climate change, rather than taking the necessary steps to reduce carbon emissions and live sustainably on the planet. The term geoengineering covers a range of large-scale climate manipulation proposals, such as ocean fertilisation to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, dispersing sulfur aerosols in the stratosphere to create global dimming, whitening clouds to improve their reflectivity, or sending small mirrors out into space to reflect the sun. These methods are hypothetical and unproven, but for fossil fuel proponents and those daunted by the prospect of serious action on climate change, they excite eager interest. At the World Social Forum, Naomi Klein talked about overcoming the appeal of geoengineering and working towards a successful Rio Plus 20. Her talk was recorded by 3CR's Elena McMaster, who attended the World Social Forum as a Friends of the Earth campaigner.
A lot of us here probably believe that we understand the ambitions and the depths of the colonization of public space, of the privatization of our world, and then we learn about all of these new frontiers out there, and you really see a causal relationship between the political failure to deal with climate change and this, the embrace of technologies like geoengineering and these ideas like pouring sulfur into the stratosphere in order to dim the sun. But this is not science fiction. This is really happening. And I have been going to gatherings of the scientists and policymakers who are taking this very seriously indeed. And after the collapse in Copenhagen, we've really seen an acceleration of this, because even the governments that are, like the U.S. government, that are very proud, supposedly, of what happened in Copenhagen and touting the joys of the Copenhagen Accord, what they do know is that it in no way averts climate chaos. And so they are actively pursuing this so-called Plan B behind closed doors. So this gathering is about Rio, and many of you may have heard this story, many of you may not. It may be an apocryphal story, but there was a big debate at the first Rio summit about whether or not then-President George Bush Sr. would attend the Earth Summit. And it was touch and go there for a while. But at the very last minute, he did go. But he said in an interview something that has been repeated over and over. He said, "We're here. We want to be involved in these negotiations. But I want to make one thing clear, and that's that the American way of life is not up for negotiation." And I think it's really important for us to understand that in the 20 years since, that has been the case. That has been the underlying logic. And not only has the American way of life not been up for negotiation, but those 20 years have seen a rapid acceleration of the globalization of the so-called American way of life. And what is that American way of life? It is based on the idea that there will always be more. That is at the very heart of what is sometimes called the American dream. The idea of endless, constant growth, that there will always be a new frontier. As soon as you reach one limit, you will be able to transcend it. And so this is just a telling and a retelling of the narrative that is really at the heart of Western culture, a new frontier. And sometimes the frontiers are physical frontiers, but more often now they are technological frontiers that tell us that we will be able to overcome the physical limits with these new technologies. But it's this expansionist logic and the logic that is at the heart of the scientific revolution that men were apart from nature and had the capacity to put nature into constraints, and this is the famous Francis Bacon quote, and make it new by the art and the hand of man. And interestingly enough, Francis Bacon's writings and ideas inspired the creation of the Royal Society in the 1600s in Britain, and now the Royal Society is the primary champion and the most powerful and most credible champion of the idea that we can fix the planet, fix the sky through technology, through geoengineering. I say all of this because I think it's important that we understand that we are in the midst not just of a political and ecological crisis, but also of a narrative crisis. We find ourselves locked in a narrative loop. We've told ourselves these same stories about our ability to dominate each other, our ability to dominate the planet, and also that no matter what happens, we will be saved. I mean, this is at the heart of so many biblical myths, you know, get yourself into enough trouble and an ark will come along and take you and your friends away. So in other words, you don't have to deal with the effects of your actions. There's always an escape hatch. And so there's something strange about these sci-fi solutions. And it's interesting that we use the word sci-fi because, of course, we have imagined this future so many times in Hollywood movies and science fiction books that it's almost as if it's happened already. It has an air of inevitability about it. And that is the power of story, the stories that we've been locked into. So I think as we look forward to Rio, I think we need to understand the depths of the challenge that we face, that when we challenge these technologies, we really are challenging the stories at the center of Western culture, what we call civilization. And in a sense, it precipitates a crisis to challenge these technologies, because even though they seem really far out there, synthetic biology, reflecting the sun back to space, fertilizing the oceans, the truth is that they fit perfectly within our current economic, social, and cultural paradigms. This is what we do. We dominate nature. We use our ingenuity to fix any problem. We overcome any limits. We always find a new frontier. So even if we have an initial feeling of, whoa, there's something wrong with that, the only thing that we have to do in order to bring on the reality is nothing, is just to sort of go limp and let it happen. Because all the momentum of our society is propelling us towards that future. It is what we do, only more so, right? Only more extreme. So that's the bad news, is that this is the story, and this is the logical conclusion of the story that we've been telling ourselves for so long. And we have been manufacturing landscapes on a massive scale. You know, I live in Canada. The tar sands are visible from space. It's the largest industrial project in the world. It is not oil drilling. It is the skinning of the earth. The tar sands cover an area as large as England. So we are already engaged in a process of dramatically changing the earth. And so all we're talking about when we talk about colonizing the sky and doing that deliberately, it is just more of the same. But that said, there is a different quality to it. But before I move on there, I think one of the things that's striking about it is that the similarities in the logic of how we talk about climate change and how we're proposing to fix it through technology. This idea of fixing the sky, the idea of reflecting the sun's rays back, assumes that the Earth's climate systems are simple enough that we could treat the Earth as if it had a thermostat attached to it, and when it gets too hot, you can just turn down the temperature. And that, of course, assumes that climate change is just a temperature problem, that it isn't part of a broader ecological crisis and a part of a broader pattern where we're hitting all kinds of ecological limits, not just the limits of the atmosphere to absorb the carbon that we're putting into it, but the limits of the ocean to absorb the stresses of overfishing, or of our soil to absorb the pressures of industrial farming, or of our aquifers to sustain the pressures that we're putting on them and the pollutants that we're putting into them. These are all interconnected, and in some ways climate is only the most visible, the most dramatic, and the scariest, but they're all interconnected. But so instead we just treat it as if it's a temperature problem, so we can just turn down the temperature. But that, in a way, is the arrogance with which our governments are treating the climate crisis right now. Because we act as if we have the ability to control, you know, how much are we going to, are we going to allow temperatures to increase? 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees, 3 degrees. These are the arrogant discussions that take place in Copenhagen and Cancun, and that will take place in Durban in a few months. The assumption being that we have that kind of control. Of course we don't have that kind of control. All we know, based on the science, is that we need to do a U-turn now and radically reduce our emissions. The idea that we could allow the temperature to increase just a little bit, but turn it down and stop it before things get really bad, and that we wouldn't be overwhelmed by tipping points, is pure fantasy. And it isn't coming from the climate scientists, it's coming from the economists with very little knowledge of the science, imposing their mechanistic thinking on the climate science and their illusions of control that have failed so spectacularly in the realm of economics, and now applying it to climate, which is quite terrifying. So my point is that we already act as if the Earth has a thermostat, and now we're just taking it to a more literal realm. So the bad news is these technologies, this Earth grab, is just more of what we've already been doing. We've already privatized everything we can think of. Now we're seeing new frontiers that we didn't even know existed. We already act as if we can have control over systems that are vastly more complex than we're able to control. The good news is that somewhere inside of us, as we go into this more extreme realm of re-engineering the building blocks of life, changing the sky, changing the ocean deliberately, something inside us rebels. And what we see is that people's first reactions, and I'm not just talking about people at the World Social Forum, generally people's first reaction to hearing about geoengineering is, no, there's something wrong with that. So actually, it's work to overcome an instinct, an instinct of self-preservation, a memory of another relationship to nature, and these technologies awaken that in us, awaken that. And that is something that I think that we need to build on as we think about how we get off this course. Because I don't think we get off this course just by saying no. I think we get off this course by recognizing these stories that we are trapped in and trying to think of the kinds of stories that we need to tell, that we need to weave, that can inspire us to evolve, to change our way of life, so that it isn't leading us towards this future that actually, when we hear described, frightens us, terrifies us. And I do believe that Rio provides an opportunity for us to engage in this new kind of collective storytelling.
On Wings, you are listening to Canadian author and activist Naomi Klein. She was speaking to the World Social Forum in Dakar, Senegal in 2011. When she says Rio, it's the then-upcoming 20th anniversary of the first UN World Conference on Environment and Development. At the end of the 2012 reunion event, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon would intone, "No longer can we afford to recklessly consume scarce resources. No longer can we carelessly pollute fragile ecosystems. No longer can we mortgage our future for our short-term needs." Easier said than done. Again, Naomi Klein, as heard on Australia's community radio program, Women on the Line. She rejects the idea that geoengineering would be a good short-term solution to global warming.
I think about why people have that sort of instant fear, that instant cringe when they hear about these technologies. I think it has to do with the fact that there is something inside so many of us that longs for wild places or places that we actually haven't already colonized with our technology, with our pollution, that we haven't already left our imprint on. And so the idea that we would do this to space, that we would do this to the stratosphere, that we would do this to the sky, is very frightening. And I was in Louisiana shortly after the oil rig exploded and sank, and the waters were just filled with oil last June. And I actually flew over the ground zero of the disaster site. And this was the point where, you know, you've all seen the images where the ocean was just striped. It looked like it was bleeding. The Gulf looked like it was bleeding. There were these massive stripes of oil, and they were red, sort of rusty red. But when you have that sort of aerial view and looking down on it, I was in a Coast Guard plane, you know, it was oil till the horizon. And what was most disturbing about it was just this feeling of claustrophobia, like you don't realize until you're confronted with it the extent to which you count on there being places like the open ocean that seem in some way to be too vast to be changed by our behavior. But then suddenly you look at the open ocean and it looks like the bottom of a garage, it looks like the bottom of an auto repair shop, and you realize actually we have gone that far. And that's, I think, why geoengineering is so frightening and why we need to articulate what it is about it that's frightening. And because it's a healthy fear, it's some kind of an instinct that's being awakened in us.
You're listening to Women on the Line on the Community Radio Network. You can find us online at womenontheline.org.au, subscribe to the podcast at 3cr.org.au/podcasts, or like us at facebook.com/womenontheline, where you can listen to our radio shows with just one click. We return now to Naomi Klein, speaking to climate activists at this year's World Social Forum.
The environmental movement, the big green environmental movement, I think is a huge part of the problem here. And you know, when I was in Copenhagen for the climate summit, one of the things that really struck me about that space was it in no way felt like a gathering about the Earth, even though there were globes everywhere. Everywhere you looked in Copenhagen, you would just see like a giant Earth, right? And everywhere in the conference center, there were all of these globes. And I started to think actually that this is part of the problem, that the symbol of the modern environmental movement has been that image of the Earth taken from space, from the Apollo. And you know, it's sometimes credited with giving birth to the modern environmental movement that we saw this fragile blue planet from space and realized that we had to protect it. But I'm actually starting to think that this astronaut's eye view of the planet is really quite damaging. Because I think if you're just looking at the Earth from space, and you have a problem like climate change that you're confronted with, then I think ideas, technological fixes, start to make more sense. All the false solutions that we've been talking about of just sort of moving around the right to pollute, carbon credits, make sense. If you have this astronaut's eye view from space, instead of looking at it from ground level. And so, you know, for instance, you'll have big environmental groups saying that natural gas is a clean fossil fuel, is a good transition fossil fuel. And people on the ground who are actually dealing with this technology are saying the methods of extraction, hydraulic fracturing or fracking, are poisoning our aquifers. It's incredible violence to the earth. Imagine deliberately creating thousands and thousands of underground earthquakes in order to extract and pumping toxins into the earth and poisoning the aquifers in order to get this stuff out. That's a clean fuel only if you're looking at it from space, right? And so much of the discussion around climate has been this astronaut's eye view. You know, we'll protect the forests and you keep polluting here. And the foundations of ecological consciousness, which are about that impulse to live in harmony with the planet and to protect, are totally lost. And so one of my wishes for Rio is that this can be a place where the so-called environmental movement comes back down to Earth from outer space. and it can once again be about land as opposed to the quote-unquote Earth. So this is a big challenge. And the challenge, as I said, is that, you know, stories have their own momentum. Now, I know this isn't just about stories. Yes, it's about corporate power. Yes, it's about political power. But stories have their own logic and their own momentum pushing us towards the conclusions that we've already imagined in every Hollywood movie that comes along and there's a savior at the end, right? And in every biblical myth, in every flattering narrative about how we are so clever that even if we haven't figured out the technological solution yet, we will, right? So let's build more dirty coal-fired plants because we are going to master carbon capture and storage. And we believe so strongly in our ability to master nature that we have faith in technologies that do not exist. I mean, the scientists who are advocating geoengineering research most aggressively admit that they have no idea whether this can work. It's entirely untested, but the mere prospect of it is enough to derail the real conversation that we need to have, which is about putting that American way of life up for negotiation. So how do we get out of this narrative loop? And as I said, I don't think that we do it just by saying this story is wrong, you know, just by saying no. Because actually, when you say this, we don't want an earth grab, we can't solve the problems of our ecological crisis simply with technology, we are putting our society into crisis. Now, that's a good thing because it actually is in crisis already. We need to change it. But we have to understand that there's a kind of a world disintegration that happens when you challenge people's fundamental myths, their fundamental stories. And if you're going to do it, there has to be something to replace it. You know, people will not let go of these ideas unless they can see a route out of it. There's a project in the UK called Dark Mountain, and it's a group of writers and artists who are engaged in a project that they call Uncivilization. And they have an Uncivilization manifesto where they say it is the end of our world, but it isn't the end of the world, right? Which is very important in challenging the apocalyptic myths at the heart of Western culture, where we're assuming that just because our way of life does indeed need to change, that is catastrophe, that's the end of the world. So we need stories that tell us convincingly that even though we need to change our lives dramatically, we can enjoy this process, we can benefit from this process in deeper ways than in material ways. So we have to be not just activists in the traditional sense, we have to be storytellers. And we have to believe in those stories ourselves. And this is why I think the process that's coming out of Bolivia is so important. Bolivia is putting forward a narrative about the rights of Mother Earth, the rights of nature, which is a fundamental challenge to the narrative that governs economic decision-making, that governs our culture, our society around the world. And so we have this alternative narrative that more than showing us that nature has rights is fundamentally based on our interdependence with nature, that our future, that our rights are bound in the rights of the natural world. We also need to tell that story that broadens this out from climate, grounds it in the earth, links the climate crisis with the broader ecological and also the broader economic crisis, because the ecological crisis happening at the same time that the financial crisis is at its peak, we need to show how these are interconnected, because of course they are. Because we have an economic model that is built on the idea of there always being more, of there always being new frontiers. But actually, we can't sustain this model because people are so impoverished around the world that they can't shop fast enough to sustain the level of growth that capitalism requires. And that's why you have these bubbles around debt, where people treat their homes like an ATM machine, their credit cards are maxed out, because they have to use debt as a tool to keep people shopping even when they can't afford it. And it is that ceaseless consumption that is, of course, at the very heart of our ecological crisis. So as we come to terms with the fact that we have hit those limits, we need to be telling stories that tell us that the world is not an endless frontier, that there is such a thing as cause and effect, and we need these circular narratives to replace the linear narratives that have governed our societies. And I noticed that so many people here are coming from Western countries. So it's really our work. But the fact that we're here at the World Social Forum in Dakar, I think is a very good start, because we're not starting from zero. That's a little bit more good news. We're not inventing new stories, right? In so many ways, we're remembering older stories. And we need to be respecting the cultures that have done a much better job of keeping those stories alive. Whether those cultures are in Africa, whether they're in Latin America like Bolivia, or whether they are in our own countries, in my country, Canada, where First Nations people across the country have been at the forefront of every major environmental struggle and are the reason why the oil companies and the tar sands are running scared and are having trouble laying their pipelines across British Columbia, across the United States. So we need to develop relationships of genuine solidarity, and also we need to be better students of these stories and spread these messages. I think that despite the dangers in the direction in which we're going, the fact that we're starting this conversation now and thinking about this process of what our alternative stories can be provides us with an opportunity to turn Rio into the place where the environmental movement comes down to Earth from outer space and where we begin to reweave the world. Thank you.
That was Naomi Klein speaking at the World Social Forum in Dakar in February. Thanks to 3CR's Elena McMaster for being there and reporting it for us. And that's all for Women on the Line this week. We'd love to hear your comments or thoughts about the program, so please leave a comment on our Facebook page. Women on the Line is Community Radio's National Women's Current Affairs program. It's produced and presented by a range of women broadcasters from 3CR in Melbourne and broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network, with funding support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. The theme music for Women on the Line is Slideshow at Free University by La Tigra. I'm Eleanor McInerney. Hope you can tune in again next time.
Wings thanks Women on the Line for the content of this program. To hear it again, you can email wings@wings.org. Special thanks to our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose website is gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.